For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's always nice to see you all, at least in the mediated way in which we're doing so. Today, I want to talk about a particular formulation of the Mahayana teachings that are known as the Paramitas, and I particularly want to focus on three of them. I'm going to talk about all of them very, very briefly, but I want the emphasis to land where you will see it landing. Okay? These have come up before a lot, of course. We talk about them. And I want to talk about them here not particularly as, you know, truth or as some kind of doctrine, but more pragmatically, as something we might think about as good to think with, good to hold in mind and play with in the current situation. When I say good to think with and not doctrinally, I mean that I want to present them with a certain looseness and a kind of playfulness. This isn't the way they're usually talked about, I think, but I hope it will hew to that spirit, and we could say in that sense that what I'm going to engage in here with you is a kind of what I would hope is a form of responsible play. Okay, the current situation that I refer to, of course, is pandemic, right? This means pandemic, the sense of the word, as I'm sure you know, it means all people. And there's a very, very real sense in which we're all in this together. But it's really important to bring to mind that we are not in this in the same way. We are all affected in radically different ways. I speak to you this morning as somebody who is safe, who's healthy, who's financially relatively secure. I haven't lost my job along with 33 million plus people in the last month or two. As of now, I have access to healthcare. Many, many, many people don't. Tens of millions of people have lost their jobs. Tens of thousands of people, well, now we're into the millions, I think, possibly, around the world have died. And this will be with us for a while. And so we can't forget this sense that we're all in it together, but we're all in it in different ways. And for that reason, I want to emphasize a different sense of the all of pandemic. And that's the sense that whoever we are and however we're positioned, we are all affected in our entirety as complete people. And Dharma practice and in general, and the Paramitas in particular, address this, ourselves in our wholeness as people, without obscuring the differences, I think. The Paramitas offer a way to think about and respond to how we are in our entirety in this situation, while staying alert to and responsive to inequities and difference. First, a note about the word paramita itself. Para can be glossed in different ways. Sometimes we, one way of doing it is to, some people attach it etymologically to a sense of perfection. So we talk about the perfection of wisdom, prajnaparamita, that kind of thing. And there's another sense in which the para seems to refer to going beyond. The etymology is not entirely clear, but it has both of those valences. And this morning, I want to focus on the going beyond aspect of that. We see echoes of this para, which is a Sanskrit word, in English words. We're in the same language family, and we see it in the sense of English words like paragon, paramount, and so on. The mita is taken to mean, broadly speaking, virtue. Thus, for example, in Prajnaparamita, we gloss it as the perfection of wisdom or transcendent wisdom, whatever that might mean. You know, that's the work of our practice anyway. But I would encourage us to think of virtues not as states. Could somebody raise a hand? Are people hearing me okay? Yeah. Okay. I would encourage us to think of virtues not as sort of states that, you know, or qualities that inhere in our personhood, whatever that might be, but as sort of capacities or powers that we can develop and exercise. That is, we can think of virtue as a kind of efficacious force or power that can be exercised, developed, and practiced. Now, I'm going to talk about six paramitas. Sometimes it's spoken of, for example, in the Dashabhumika, the list is given as 10. And in that longer list, one of them that I'll just mention in passing is power. And that kind of resonates here. But I'm going to talk about the six, and we can think of the virtue or powers here, as I said, as efficacious as doing something in us and in the world. And, you know, we might, an example of that sense of efficaciousness actually exists in the English word virtue, one of the definitions of which is precisely that, so that we could talk about something, we could say something reasonably like, I have confidence in the virtue of Sazen. All right. So what are these six paramitas? Usually they're presented in this order: generosity, morality or ethics, shila, patience, effort or energy, concentration, or wisdom. And they're usually kind of talked about in that order, with wisdom, prajna, as a kind of culmination in a sense. That happens a lot. But as I've been taught, and I think in Zen generally, there's sort of a more of a holographic sense. They occur and arise together. Now, I don't want to say a lot this morning about wisdom or meditation. In fact, I want to reverse the order entirely. There's a sense in which, it's a dangerous word, I suppose, but we might think of wisdom as what? Maybe epiphenomenal, that is, as something that arises and accompanies the exercise of the other ones. And in fact, so far as I see it, that kind of makes sense, because when I think about it, there's no real specific practice that we can undertake to express and develop wisdom. In the same way, I mean, I can determine for myself, I can get up in the morning and say, I'm going to make an effort to be more generous, in a way that I can't say, I'm just going to be more wise this morning. It doesn't work that way. Rather, in this schematic, it's a kind of natural function of the practices of the other virtues, the other paramitas. And as Suzuki Roshi says from another point of view, it is wisdom that seeks wisdom. That is to say, you know, to challenge this word of epiphenomenal, it's not quite right, but it's like, it's more like prajna is not a result of the others, but rather something that permeates and strengthens through the exercise of the entire process, through our practice. It sets us on a path, it sets us on the path through our sort of felt sense that our own lives and the world itself are kind of out of whack. We call this dukkha. And we talk here about, so moving on from prajna, we talk here about jhana or zen meditation all the time. I mean, that's our bread and butter in Dharma talks. So I don't want to say a lot about that so much either. So what about the other four, which continuing to work backwards are, the next one would be sila or morality. Ethics. This includes the precepts, of course. It's my view, and maybe it's just a view, that it's actually a much broader kind of category, and it includes very practically, you know, how we actually move through the world and live our lives in a skillful and compassionate way. So this would include everything from, you know, literally how we move, how we handle things, how we sit, how we eat. It's how we show up in the world, moment to moment. So we can ask ourselves, how can we refine and mold our awakeness and refine and mold our sensitivity in interacting with other people? That's all I'll say about that. The next is patience or forbearance, tolerance, kshanti. Now, we are bound, you may have experienced, to become a little bit discouraged by situations, and we can become disappointed in both ourselves and in others. And we might think about patience, kshanti, as a kind of tenacity, something that we need in order to not turn away from ourselves or others and not to succumb to discouragement, either in our practice or in our practice internally, when, if we think about it that way, when we're actually doing zazen, or in our interactions with people and situations. Suzuki Roshi proposes in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that the one good word for this might be a kind of constancy. Now, this constancy, this ability to stay with things, to not turn away, relies on the next one, virya, which is effort or energy. We need to find within ourselves the resources to bring ourselves fully to our lives and to our practice. And how is this possible, really? It is precisely, not surprisingly, through the practice of meditation, through the practice of ethics and precepts, careful and caring presence in the world, and through patience. And this is what I meant, I think before I used the word, when I was talking about playfulness, maybe I dropped it out, but there's a kind of a holographic quality to the paramitas. They all, in a sense, include each other. And this, I think, sort of shows that. There's a very common word in Japanese, many of you may know it, gambaru. It means literally something like to stand firm. You might hear it a dozen times a day in a million situations. It's very, very common. And it's usually in the sort of imperative form. People say to each other in all kinds of situations, gambate or gambate kudasai. And I think it's interesting, not because there's some great connection between Japanese culture and Zen teachings. I mean, that's a whole topic. We can talk about the way those overlap and the way Zen informs Japanese culture, and, you know, more problematically, perhaps the way Japanese culture infuses the practice of Zen. But it's the idea of not only dealing with things and not crumbling in the face of difficult situations, but coming up with a kind of an extra spark that will actually turn the situation. And in that, patience and effort kind of come together to create the conditions of the possibility of the last virtue, the last paramita in this sort of reverse sequence, which is dana, or generosity. Now, discussions of generosity often focus on material and emotional support to others. And both of these are really completely legitimate, hugely important, and fundamental. You know, these are difficult times. All times are difficult times. So it's useful to ask, you know, in this situation, the human situation, what's helpful and what isn't? It's my opinion, I guess. I think it is almost always useful or helpful, for example, to give people the benefit of the doubt. It's helpful to loosen up a little bit, to forgive ourselves and others for our innumerable and inevitable inadequacies. And that's a form of generosity. I hope I don't need to argue here that to say forgiveness, you know, is not the same as not holding ourselves or others to account. But it's useful, I think, to shift our focus from this notion of what we give, right, to the other side of that, the continual act of letting go of limited views, unrealistic expectations, and so on. So we can focus here less on generosity as giving per se, and maybe shift it more to, especially in a time like this, to what is it that we can do that is generative? You know, there's a link there linguistically. What is generative? What is life supporting? What is life giving? What is life sustaining? Sometimes the goal of practice, if we want to slip into that language of goals or the point, is described as learning how to give up false views and afflictive emotional states. Specifically, false views and conflictive emotions about the world, and especially about our nature as human beings. What does it mean to be a human being? I'd like to hear shift to something that's not given as a paramita, but I think it's useful here. And this is the notion of mindfulness. Mindfulness is usually spoken of as in American quote unquote spiritual culture, as a kind of active presencing in which we, get instructions about how to bring focused attention to the physical sensations of eating, walking, washing dishes, and so on. And this is good. This is really useful. In Sanskrit, sort of the root language of Buddhism, or one of them, the word is sati, or I can't say this. I wouldn't have any idea how to say it. I think it's something like smriti, S-M-R-T-I. Now, this term is highly technical in discussions of what we might call meditation theory. So if you look at a lot of Theravadan stuff, for example, there are very technical discussions of how this functions with other capacities and so on. And for example, one of our ancestors, the Sangha, spoke of it as one of the five functions that come into play in meditation, you know, specifically as something that helps us attend to whatever the object of meditation is. If we're talking about meditation as something that has an object, which of course in Zen we finesse a little bit. It's an objectless meditation. But the others in this list would be aspiration, determination, concentration, and wisdom. With the end of in meditation, breaking free of unwholesome, unhelpful responses to what the mind is presented with, which you know, manifest as greed, hate, and delusion, to use that shorthand. But notice that these strongly overlap with the paramitas. And I mention this because of something else that Asanga says, which is that one of these functions, including sati, is present. They are all present. And again, this gets to this holographic quality of the paramitas and practice in general. And in fact, this actually echoes the something that Suzuki Roshi says specifically of the paramitas, which is that when we speak of them, we're actually speaking of only one thing, and that one thing is spoken of simply in six different ways. In short, when we're talking about the paramitas, we're just talking about practice in one particular idiom or one particular mode. And this points, I think, towards another more general sense of mindfulness, you know, that is sati or remembering, which is that it's specifically, you know, a more general sense, which is just to remember to, to remember and to apply the teachings, right, in their totality, moment to moment and over time, both inwardly and outwardly. Simply to, and this is what I mean by thinking with it, good to think with, to like develop the capacity to have that with us in some sort of aware way at all times. I would submit that this is all times, but especially a time like this, is really, really an excellent time to practice with and apply the paramitas, and especially patience and energy and generosity in our meditation practice and relation to our personal lives, whatever it means to be Nyozan or Shut in the world at this moment, and in our relationship with others. I have some tiny little note here that I can't see. In fact, I can't even read it. And to go back to what I was saying in the beginning, thinking and living with the paramitas are transcendental in this specific and, as I would say, kind of playful sense that both in Zazen and in the world, they can lead to sort of moving beyond the boundaries imposed by sort of unhelpful, unwholesome, and truly inaccurate fixations on some kind of idea of self as somehow separate, as standing outside and opposed to the totality of being. I think we, I'm a little hesitant to do this, but I think now, in our practice, this might be a good time. We might profitably sort of set aside whatever kind of obsession we might have in our practice with the big notions of, say, capital G, great compassion, perfect wisdom, and so on. And after all, lots of, Dogen says, give up all ideas of enlightenment. And, Rinzai says similar things. Instead, I would encourage us to maybe be a little more humble and work on how together we can all move through this weird, bizarre time just more empathetically and more insightfully and more patiently. The practice of the paramitas and bringing them to mind, struggling with them intellectually, or thinking them through, not struggling, thinking them through, and letting it unfold and ripen in our meditation practice, just working with them now might just be a little bit helpful. And so with that, I will say, Ganbatte kudasai. And I will, of course, welcome any questions, but especially comments and insights that people might want to share. We can all talk together. You don't all have to talk to me. I've said my bit. So yes, that's that.
We can't hear you, Douglas.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, I'm not muted, so all right. Nyozan is attending using a phone, so he will have limited visibility to the gallery and won't be able to see necessarily who has raised the hand to make a comment or ask a question. So I think the easiest thing to do is for me to be a moderator and recognize someone who's raised a hand, and then you can unmute and make your comment or ask your question to Nyozan. Susan. Susan, you can ask your question.
Okay. If anyone might be able to shed some light on the role of saying no in not turning away, that would be very helpful. I mean, how do we not turn away in a situation and yet say no?
Say no to, could you elucidate a little? Say no to what?
Well, for example, if someone asks you to do something and you don't find yourself at that time able to carry forward with whatever that request is, and you have to say no, I can't do it right now. My sense is that that's also that kind of limit, recognizing a limit is also a kind of gift that we can offer, but I wondered what other people might say to that.
Somebody else may have something more helpful to add. I would simply say that this connects with the idea of not holding ourselves as somehow separate from the rest of everything else, so that we need to, in applying the care and the love expressed in the paramitas, we both need to be realistic about our limitations and respect them. We are not helping others when we go beyond what we can provide to another person. And this requires a little bit of settledness and a little bit of intellectual and emotional clarity. There are certainly times to we have limits, and they're permeable, but it's best not to pretend otherwise, I think. Does anybody else have something to say about that?
I might add to what you said, Nyozan, just that it's possible to say no to a particular request, but still be attentive to the person and situation where the request is coming from, not to abandon that person. So it's no doesn't have to be a total rejection. It's just this request is something that I am unable to take care of right now. But that doesn't mean, you know, just no to the person. You still can be attentive and friendly.
Yeah, maybe I just would, I would add, I usually have problems along those lines when I say yes. So no is far easier for me. I mean, I actually have confusion and disorientation and a sense of separation when I accede to a request. So I think it works either way. In a way, the no yes is it might be just a formality or an object itself, at least in my mind, in the relationship that is irrelevant to the request being made, potentially.
Thank you.
David.
Thank you very much for this talk. And my question is totally naive because this body of knowledge is really new to me. I mean, it puts Prajna Paramita into a new context. I'm super excited about it. A thing that I do some in my professional life is teach people, you know, things like Aristotle and Hellenistic philosophy at a really low level. And I'm amazed and find really remarkable the points of contact and comparison. My question is, are there specific either practices or I don't know, like modes of inquiry or things that I might read, or what's like, I'm super interested in this, and I have a bit of time on my hands. So what would be a good way to move forward?
Well, again, I will invite comments from other people because you've asked the right person in terms of asking a naive question, because I'm in many ways quite naive about this too. But yes, there's a vast literature. You're probably familiar with Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. There are some really wonderful sections in there that I think deal with the paramitas. And, you know, make other suggestions. It's interesting that you bring up Aristotle, because I'm terribly naive about Aristotle also. But, you know, I do have this sense of, you know, from reading Nicomachean Ethics, 40 years ago, that he sort of shares this sense. I mean, it's very different, of course. The whole idiom is very different. But there is this sense that virtue is not something theoretical, something you figure out exactly, but you live it out. It has to do with kind of skillfulness in living. And that's very resonant with the way they're presented in Buddhism, I think. I will try to come up with some specific places I might guide you to and email you or something, but other people may have suggestions.
Just to start a reading list on this, David, there's a good book about the six paramitas by Dale Wright, Wright, who's a very fine scholar of Buddhism. There's also a new book by Norman Fisher in our lineage, which I haven't had a chance to look at yet. And there's also a very fine book by my teacher, Reb Anderson, that just came out recently called Entering the Mind of Buddha, which is exactly about these six paramitas. There are plenty of other things, too. There's a chapter in my Faces of Compassion book about the 10 paramitas. But yeah, you can email me at info@ancientdragon.org if you want me to send you that list again. So.
Yeah, Robert Aitken has a couple of books, The Practice of Perfection and The Mind of Clover, which are really about the paramitas as well. And so those are pretty good places to start as well. But I liked Reb's most recent book a lot.
I'll just add that we did a practice period on the paramitas a little while ago. So if you go back in the Ancient Dragon podcast archives, there are bunches of talks. So these practices we talk about a lot, and they're kind of very practical, basic ways of applying our meditation mind.
Well, I'll jump in. Thanks for your talk, Yozan. I think something that's struck me recently and it resonates with part of your talk is the last line of the Hymn to the Perfection of Wisdom, that the practice of perfection of the Buddha sets in motion the wheel of Dharma, which is making the point that Prajna is not the end of our practice, it's the very beginning, and all of the acts of compassion and patience and generosity and so on are grow out of and are expressions of wisdom.
Yes.
It also suggests, that being the case, that wisdom isn't some abstract quality that's limited to some sort of knowledge or intellectual quality that a person has, but it's an aspect or a mode of acting, a kind of behavior.
Yes, and of course that actually also resonates very strongly with Dogen's notion of practice realization. Realization is not itself, it's co-arising with practice itself. It's not something that's outside that's the product. That's what realization looks like. It looks like wisdom, generosity, the precepts, and so on. They're together. Yeah.
Oh. Go ahead.
Thank you for your talk, Niozan. I had a question about, you know, energy, and I guess sort of also wanting some direction on like practices for energy. You know, I don't know if other people are having this experience in the pandemic, but it's at times, you know, suddenly I'll feel like really kind of inexplicably like tired, and you know, and kind of wondering where my energy went and wanting it back. And so I'm just wondering, you know, and there's a thing of like, well, it's really difficult to decide like, oh, now I'm going to be energetic in a way, you know?
Yes.
So just wondering kind of, yeah, the nuts and bolts of if not getting energy back in some way, but also not just sort of, or maybe there's nothing wrong with like giving into the tiredness, but I don't know, practices around energy, I'm sort of interested in that idea. So,
You know, again, people wiser and more articulate than I can dive in here and help with that. But I'm reminded of a few months back, as all started to unfold, I was doing a pilgrimage in Italy, walking a lot every day. And there was one particular instance I remember where there was a very difficult, steep, long little section there. And somebody had painted on a little rock, you know, you had to bend over to read it. And I don't speak Italian, so I'm not sure I can quote it. It was something like, quando le gambe stanche cammina con il cuore, which means when your legs are tired, walk with your heart. And I thought at the time, wow, this is like a very, was some other Zen guy walking along here or something like that? But, you know, that walking with the heart, I think at least minimally points to finding things that you actually enjoy when you're tired. Take yourself away from the concerns that are weighing you down. And in a sense, not a good word, but in a sense, indulge yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, find some music that you like. Find a way to walk. Find a way to physically energize yourself. Go for a walk. Things like that. But again, I hope others have something more astute to say.
There's really helpful. I have two suggestions here, going in, coming from different directions. One is taking short naps. Last night, I was dead on my feet at 6:15 p.m. I put on a Sibelius symphony, did not set the alarm, went to lie down, and 35 minutes later, I woke up totally refreshed. And I was that way until midnight when I forced myself to turn up light and go to sleep. The other thing is doing Qigong exercises in the Taoist tradition, which are way complementary to the Zen tradition, that circulate the energy in the body along different meridians and can help you work through that tiredness. There other people may know of more specific sources for the Qigong exercises. There's a teacher that I take classes with in New York, but there are probably more local options.
Well, we happen to have with us, or did a minute ago, Paula Lazar, another priest at our temple, who's a Qigong master and may have something to say here.
Paula,
hello. Well, we do some Qigong retreats at Ancient Dragon, but simplistically, it could be helpful to connect with your breath and to just pull the breath down into the lower abdomen as deeply as you can, 3, 6, or 9 times. And this also will help bring your focus completely on the breath. And if you could bring your focus completely on the breath, the mind calms, the body relaxes, you get reoxygenated, and hopefully that will help give you another burst of your energy. But I will say, I'm the big believer in the nap. So yeah. If you're really tired, lay down. 20 minutes is usually ideal. It's like taking a drink of water when you're really, really thirsty. So if you're not used to doing Qigong, but this is one way to start, is to connect with the breath and breathe deeply at whenever you think about it. But if you're not used to that, if you could do a 20-minute nap, not longer, because then you get into different sleep states, you'll feel very, very refreshed when you wake up. Set an alarm, do it, and you'll feel great.
Thank you, Paula. And if I may just add to that, as sort of an adjunct of the actual sleep part of the nap, there's the bit of going into a nap and coming out of a nap where you get a little fuzzy and, you know, things kind of loosen up mentally. You're a little dreamy and stuff like that. And that might just in itself help to loosen up. Oftentimes when we're tired, it's because we're kind of mentally obsessing or trying to get a grip on something that essentially, like in a situation like this, there's no grip possible. There's no real purchase possible. We have to swim. So yeah, naps, breathing. And I see that it's 11:03. So I think unless somebody has something really urgent. Other, you know, people may have things to go on to in their day. So we should probably stop. So one last call for the insight that's going to carry us through.
I don't know if this is that insight, but I've been sort of holding this in the whole time. So I was in a Protestant church with a friend, and this is about as far from my kind of practice as I've ever been. And there was this thing on the wall, and it had patience, generosity, all of these things. And the woman next to me said, she's lovely. She said, "These are gifts." And I went, "Oh!" All of a sudden, this sort of silly little, you know, moralistic, different kind of morality, moralistic thing on the wall suddenly was this beacon. And then she turned to me, she says, "They're virtues." And I went, "Oh, that messed it up."
They are.
Yeah, it's just language. But to perceive these things as gifts, and the yes and the no. So, and believe me, I'm boundaries, but there's something about even no's can be yeses. Saying yes to that. But there's so much pushing away in times like this. I want to be generous. I want to be kind. I want to be patient. And it's mentally exhausting to generate that stance. Again, my language, I'm just pulling things out of my head. So to go back and say yes as a gift, I don't know what the Buddhist equivalent of that would be, that word. If anyone can give it to me, I would love to have it. But it was so freeing and so practicable. So that's all I have to say.
I'll just add one thing really briefly, going back to what Nyozan said about being almost indulgent, that there's this phrase, rest and recreation. And I think at times when we do feel lack of energy, or when we feel out of balance with our energy, to do something that is, as Nyozan said, enjoyable. But this word recreation also means to recreate. There's something that can be productive and creative about taking a break and going back to something that we actually enjoy and that can allow us to move forward. So thank you, Nyozan.
Yeah, thank you, Taigen. And I think that's a good way to close. It's 11:05, so I think now's the time for me to thank everybody for your patience and toleration of me this morning, and generosity in doing so. And I think we should stop and